The next speaker we have is Ty Burkett, who is a managing director with Willis Re Australia, as well as being responsible for the actuarial team across the Asia Pacific region. Ty works with insurance and government clients, advising, modelling, structuring, and placing reinsurance solutions. This involves understanding the global capital and reinsurance markets and assisting clients developing the most efficient approach to managing large and extreme risks. Prior to joining Willis Re in 2005, Ty also worked at Swiss Re, and before that as an actuarial consultant in the United Kingdom, Melbourne and Sydney. Ty's going to talk to us today about global developments in the reinsurance space and some of the hot topics around capital involvement in that area. Over to you, Ty.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. I'm okay to wander around, am I?
Yeah.
Okay. Two ways to avoid nerves, either wander around or hold on to the podium. Thanks, Andy and John, for sort of building the talk up a little bit, and everyone for giving me the opportunity. We saw in the first plenary that it was around the nature of these natural peril risks. The second plenary was around assessing those risks. And what John's talked about is the reinsurance. It's all good and well to work out you have a 1 in 200 risk of $3 billion, but if you don't do something with that risk or decide how to manage that risk, you're no better off. So what I wanted to talk about today was some of the global developments in reinsurance. Wrong way. Starting something a little bit different today. Something I read the other day was about disruptive innovation. Disruptive innovation is an innovation that creates a new market, generally at the expense of an existing market. This may happen over a few years or it might happen over a long period of time. Think about jet aeroplanes and what it did to the passenger shipping industry. Think about what cars did to the guys who sweep up the manure from the horses. Think about what the internet and bank and computers did to the banking industry and bank tellers. So there was an interesting paper written by the Citigroup around the 10 disruptive innovations for 2014. And it had a list of them. The first one was robots. Very sorry, but I'm not going to talk about robots today. I don't know much about them, but it would have been more interesting than insurance. Electric cars. We're now seeing articles around driverless cars, the implications for that. This would have implications for the petrol industry. 4D printing. I'm not quite sure what that is, whether it's 3D printing you did in the past or 3D printing you'll do in the future, but it is a disruptive innovation. Now we're getting medical, immunizations, cross-generation, multi-decades, precision agriculture, increasing affluence, increasing population, very important. Energy storage. Joe Hockey might start liking wind farms. Digital on various different fronts, and insurance securitization. Two things here. How often do you see robots and insurance securitization on the same list? And the second one is the Citigroup is a big investment bank. Now, I'm not cynical at all, but if you're a big investment bank that likes trading and buying and selling things, why wouldn't you put it in the report and try and create a new asset class to trade? Next one. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to come from an investor's perspective first. So how the investors look at reinsurance and insurance. What is this disruption? Talk about the traditional reinsurance marketplace, which will overlap with some of what John talked about. Talk about what the impact is and bring it back to on your watch, you know, what today is about. So from an investor's perspective, well, investors, whether it's the man in the street or big sovereign funds or pension funds, they're looking for a couple of things. They're looking for absolute return. And here we have owed to be an actuary in the US. This whole debate about discounting and undiscounting, the two are the same. They have no yield curve. So you have these very low absolute returns which do influence it. On the right, capital theory. If you want to make more return, you need to take more risk. If the return is too good to be true, it probably is. So basically, investors are looking both for an absolute return, but to enhance that return by taking risk. So where better than to take risks than in insurance or reinsurance and natural perils? So investors have been looking for a long time on how to take this risk and how to achieve an enhanced return. So how do they do that? Well, on the left-hand side, they could invest in shares. They could invest in shares of an existing reinsurer, and this is the share price over the years of Swiss Re. The blue arrows is when I joined and when I left. And when I learnt about the difference between an in-the-money stock option and an out-of-the-money stock option. The other area that you can get involved in reinsurance is establish a reinsurer. And what we saw on this side is we saw after Hurricane Andrew in 1992 that we spoke about this morning, various reinsurers were established to try and take advantage of the discontinuity in the market. A similar thing happened in 2001 after the World Trade Centers. We saw new reinsurers established. Again in 2005 after Katrina, Rita and Wilma. Initially, the dysfunction was the US market. They talked about two speeds of markets. And so you had this new capital come in to new reinsurers. But, and I had trouble finding a good slide for it and a good picture, but they had this concept of sidecars. So you don't need to set up a whole reinsurance company. Carve out some of the risk, put it in a separate entity and look to make a return on that. So investors had different ways of getting into the reinsurance market. However, they invest in a wide range of products. They'd like these products to look the same. So if we step back to what an investor is typically invested in, they are looking at a product that delivers them a coupon or a dividend if it shares over time and a chunk of money at the end, either on sale or the face value at the end. They pay a premium for that. And the premium will give you the ability to calculate the yield on the investment. That yield will be better if you take more risk. So you'll pay less money, get a better yield, but there's a risk there. So you might be buying a corporate bond from Westpac Bank. You might be buying a Russian government bond. Or alternatively, you could buy a reinsurance bond. And the reinsurance bond, the risk is something like Californian earthquake risk. So it operates in the same way that other investments do. The difference is Westpac Bank fails, you may not get your money. In the last example, a Californian earthquake happens, you don't get your money. The investors love this. The investors love this because one, they can try and make more return for the risk, but two, it is uncorrelated with a lot of the rest of their portfolio. So you've seen this push since the mid-90s into insurance-linked securities, cap bonds and the like, as investors have tried to tap into insurance as an asset class. And you've seen cap bonds issued all over the world. For example, Munich Re, taking components of their risk, they set it up, they slice it, they dice it, they hand it out to the investors. The investors are happy with the return they may make on it. And this has been something that's been going on since the mid-90s, as I said. So what is the disruption? This has been around for quite a while. Well, let's have a look at the global markets. The global investment assets, and you'll notice there is no source on this. I don't quite know exactly who did the maths, but $120 trillion of assets. Out of that $120 trillion of assets, $32 trillion is in pension funds. Out of that $32 trillion of assets in pension funds, $6 trillion is in alternate assets. Out of that $6 trillion in alternate assets, a lazy $50 billion is in insurance-linked securities. Now, I'm not very good with my millions, billions and trillions, but to think of that another way is if you think of the global assets as being $100, the $50 billion is equivalent to 4 cents down the back of the couch. So if you were to get 1% of the pension fund assets into insurance-linked securities, this $50 billion would go to $320 billion. So this new investment class is big in terms of $50 billion, but in the scale of the global markets is very, very small. And also very, very new. You've seen, since the turn of the century, 23% per annum growth up to $50 billion. So it's growing. But let's put that in context. If we take asset-backed securities, things like mortgages, much, much bigger numbers, $3.5 trillion. Much, much more rapid growth. But with the financial crisis, we saw a 55% drop-off. So we had the same thing with money going into mortgage-backed securities, but then we also saw a massive drop-off. So when you look on the left and wonder where it goes to next, there are different views. Okay, turning to the traditional reinsurance market. The traditional reinsurance market, in comparison to that $50 billion, has roughly $500 billion of capital. So quite a bit bigger. But there is a big difference with that $500 billion of capital. That $500 billion of capital can be leveraged. $1 of capital can be put against multiple risks. The money coming in the insurance-linked securities is collateralized. If you've got $1 of capital, you can take $1 of risk. Swiss Re, Munich Re, Hanover Re, whoever, can use that dollar multiple times. They'll crave diversification into territories where they don't need much capital. The lines are blurring. Today I've very much kept it traditional alternate. There is a lot of blurs in the middle. And when you deal with a reinsurer, there may be third-party investors behind it. But as you can imagine, flow of capital, supply and demand will impact prices. Now, if you have a look at the graph on combined ratios for reinsurers, a couple of points. 2001, World Trade Center. 2005, Katrina, Rita and Wilma. 2011, the various events, particularly in the Asia Pacific. But the last 2 years, you are seeing some very good returns. So while, and John spoke about it, while the reinsurance rates are down and the margins aren't great, there's not much red ink at the moment. The reinsurers are still making profits. So while they may not be happy with the terms, they may, in the long run, the prices may be inadequate. At the moment, they're not losing money. So you've got this capital, you've got profitable, you've got a couple of good years of natural peril experience, and you've got the ILS markets coming in. So suddenly, you're seeing all the headlines. You're seeing rates coming off considerably. You're seeing things like Japanese renewal coming off 15, 20%. And a lot of question marks around the reinsurer models. But for people who have been involved in reinsurance for many years, these things come and go in cycles. Some of these reinsurers have been around 150 plus years. Lloyd's has been around 300 years. So they do survive these hiccups. Okay, let's have a quick sip of water. Just put them side by side and just have a quick comparison. Again, I've oversimplified this. But on the left, if you look at the traditional reinsurance markets, they're global. They write business all over the world. They're overweight the US. They're overweight the US because there's a lot of people living there. They're overweight the US because there's a big economy. They're overweight the US because there's some fairly significant hurricane and earthquake perils there. They're predominantly equity funded, which gives them the ability to leverage. And they crave diversification. They look to write those risks that don't require much capital to be held against them. They might want a 15% return. Now, stop yawning, Blair. I was just looking at Blair with Berkshire Hathaway, where the reinsurance is a subset, as John was saying. So Berkshire Hathaway on the reinsurance section may not be looking for as much diversification as others, because by having a reinsurance arm, that's the diversification. So it does vary from company to company. Switching across to the alternate, it's been very much US focused. Rick hit spot on this morning. A lot of that is around. The reinsurers need a lot of capital against that US risk. The investors are in the US. The money's there. The risks, the numbers are big. So we've seen insurance-linked security and alternate risk come into the US first. There's an inability to leverage. You have $1 of capital, you take $1 of risk. Diversification, largely ignored, because you've almost created, same as my point about Berkshire, you've almost created the diversification just by having this asset class. And you might want a 6% return on the money. The two are very interrelated. If you're buying a reinsurance program and you go and place 20% of the risk, which is happening in places like Florida, into the insurance-linked market, it has an implication on the other 80%. You can squeeze that other 80% harder if you choose to, because you don't need as much capacity as you did when you need 100%. How the two markets interact and how the lines blur is quite key. They blur because the reinsurers are starting to use this behind the scenes, but also they'll impact within the market. And this comes back to the disruption I spoke about. Sorry, wrong. So let's take an example. I want to place $100 of reinsurance risk into the traditional market. The reinsurer needs to hold $40 of capital, say, and they want 15% return. 15% return on 40 is a $6 margin. Alternatively, I go to a ILS market, there's no leverage, but they only want a 6% return. So my $100 of risk, $100 of capital, they want a $6 margin. So same view of the risk, if they have the same view of the underlying risk, and that's a big if, because different people have different views of the risk as we've seen, they could end up with the same total price. So suddenly the two are equal. So if you're in a market where the leverage and someone has to hold more than 40% of capital, the ILS becomes more attractive in my very simple example. If you're in a diversified market which only holds 20% of capital, the traditional market remains more attractive. But what happens? Look at the moment. This is the capital being held. And in the US, you're holding all this capital. This is traditional reinsurance, and you're holding the most capital against the US risk. The ILS market comes in, you don't do as much business. You're now competing for the 80% rather than the 100%. Your portfolio rebalances. Potentially, you end up holding less capital against the US risk because you're writing less business. And then suddenly these other territories are not the diversifying effect they were before, and that pushes price up. So potentially there's an argument that if a whole lot of ILS money flies into the US, it could actually impact the traditional price of reinsurance in Australia. So how the thing operates and how the balance sheets operate is going to be very interesting to see over the next couple of years. Yeah, all right. Okay, bring it back to On Your Watch and the theme today. What are the things to be looking for? Obviously, we talked about the assessment of the cat risk. It's how that risk gets managed. And obviously, and there's a couple of words that John used, sustainability and the certainty around how you do this. So I'm just going to talk, not necessarily going to answer any questions about which is the best approach. And in practice, it's a combination, but just some of the things to think about. I can't remember why I put that slide in there. Some considerations, sustainability. So you go this path, what happens after an event in Sydney? What happens if there's a Sydney earthquake tomorrow? Okay, you've got your traditional reinsurers, they're going to react in a particular way, but also you've got these investment products. So you're suddenly looking at, you know, they haven't paid claims before, you haven't dealt with their claims department before, you're looking at a contract. These insurance linked securities, some of the cat bonds, the public issue, will end up with a 120-page prospectus and take 3 months to do. So they are then looking at the letter of the law. It's quite different to dealing with the traditional reinsurers. What happens post a global event? So let's say all this money flows in, and out of that $50 billion, not that many know reinsurance that well. And they go, what do you mean we didn't get our money back? There was a Californian earthquake. And so suddenly you may see a change in the appetite for the risk. You've seen money pile into these Turkish cat bonds. People are convinced the Turkish earthquake modelling is correct, and they only need a 2.5% additional return to reflect that risk. I am not a cat modeller, but I'm guessing if you talk about uncertainty, Turkish earthquake may be one area where there's a bit of uncertainty. What happens if a new asset class comes along? What happens if North Korean pork bellies are all the rage and everyone piles their money into North Korean pork bellies and pulls out of this sector? So obviously this money, these investors are not wedded to reinsurance. And again, when I say that $50 billion, there is a wide range. There's some very sustainable players in there, and there's some Johnny-come-latelys. Your partnership is with a series of investors that you'll never meet, as opposed to the reinsurer. Anyone who's had a bit of argy-bargy with their reinsurers may decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And the value of the pricing benefit. How much difference does this make to the cost? And I'm not just talking about these products, but how much it has the implication, especially in Australia. You have a regulator with a very high reinsurance requirement. You've got the IAG, Suncorps and QBEs are buying significant amounts of capacity. So how they manage it into the different sectors is very, very important. In terms of certainty, John talked about counterparty credit risk. This stuff's collateralized. Dollar of capital, dollar of risk, as long as you sit there somewhere safe, and I know APRA doesn't think the Bank of New York or a Swiss bank is safe because it's not APRA regulated, but as long as you sit it somewhere safe, the money is collateralized. So it does improve the credit quality of the panel. I would also argue that a lot of the reinsurers, the big events, not an Australian event, but a big global event, some of the reinsurers are correlated with each other. Swiss Re, Munich Re and Hanover Re, a Japanese earthquake's not going to do any of them any good. It's not going to put them insolvent, but there is a correlation between their counterparty. Investors can look at the multi-year. Some reinsurers can, some can't. Investors may not think of payback in the same way. When reinsurance goes up after an event, sometimes it's reinsurers thinking of payback and to get some of the money back. Other times it's a reassessment of the risk. The event happens and you suddenly go, ooh, that risk is much worse than I ever thought it could be. Other times it's opportunistic. So do investors look at it, roll the dice, have a bad roll in the dice, go, don't worry, we'll back up again, we'll keep playing. So again, how do the investors react? And the regulatory concerns, as I mentioned, is obviously making sure these things are sound, the money's available. And the other piece is control. How do you achieve that balance? What do you do? If you need another $100 million of cat reinsurance because you've breached your REMS, what do you do to get that $100 million? Do you do a full 120-page prospectus and put it out to investors at one absolute extreme, and there's a lot of in-betweens, or do you make two phone calls? One to your broker, and you make two phone calls, one to your broker, and your broker rings your reinsurer. In the current market, that is two phone calls, isn't it, John, because they never say no? But at different times, it may be a few more than two phone calls. You don't even have to call them. They come knocking on your door. The relationship and engagement that John spoke about is very, very important. And obviously the ability to do it. Again, that has positives and negatives. And I think a key bit with this is we're talking about The investors want things that are heavily commoditized. They want to know there is a 1.73% chance that they'll lose some money, and a 0.89% chance they'll lose all their money, and they get a 6.3% additional return. This stuff is heavily commoditized. This does not allow for some of the art involved in underwriting, and you're seeing the traditional reinsurers really emphasizing on the specialty classes where a lot of this can't play. It struggles in the casualty market. Some of it struggles in the unmodeled, or what did Scott call them, lesser modeled perils. So reinsurers are looking at the traditional thing. So we are seeing a lot of change. But I guess the question is this disruptive innovation? And so basically to finish with, is this the invention of the motor car, which changed the way people live their lives, the way cities are built, and a whole lot of industries? Or is this the Segway, which changed the way that Channel 9 films the cricket? So I've got a feeling it's probably somewhere in between the two. So thank you. Hopefully that helps you.